Okay. Yeah, this is where I have my. We're supposed to go to chapter 34. You have to excuse me. Okay, so do a little overview. Once Jacob settled on the land, he's back now, the threat from the Canaanites became a problem. This story is a tangled web of good and evil, as are all the patriarchal narratives. To Israel, this story would certainly serve as a warning against the defiling effects of interrelations with the Canaanites, evil by deception. And one thing is certain, from God's point of view, he would not want the Israel, the Jewish people, to intermarry with any group, because the final conclusion of intermarriage is assimilation. And then the line is not pure anymore. And when Yeshua came, if he did come, everything would be different. It would be very hard to make a genealogy for him. You'd have to go outside of the Jewish people. And he was to be Jewish, purely Jewish. Israel was not supposed to intermarry with them or make treaties with the Canaanites. This passage also warns against going to visit the daughters of the land. Okay? Now, we're going to do a little systematic theology here. And I'm going to be giving you some verses. As I give you these verses, think about them, because I think you'll see what direction they're going in. In fact, I want to write, so if you want to write it down, I'm going to write it up on the whiteboard. My days, we had a blackboard. Okay, let me just get these written down on here. If you want, you don't have to copy them, but if you want to. This is a little systematic theology. In other words, we're taking a topic. We're not taking a book or a passage. We're taking a topic and seeing what the Bible has to say about that topic. So first is Matthew. We'll have to do some abbreviating here to get them all on. 23. To 16 to 22. I wrote that wrong. Matthew 23. Don't look these up yet. Let me get them. 16 to 22. There's a few of them. Okay. Matthew. Five, 33 to 37. Okay. Matthew 5,
It's contained in the one above. Okay.
Psalm 15, 4. And then comes Genesis 3:4. Wait. These are going to go together, kind of. So I want to put it like this. Genesis four. And it's not going to take you long to see why I picked these out. Whoops. Matthew 23, 16 to 22. Genesis 29 to 26. I got it wrong. I'll tell you what, let me do it this way. This will be easier. Because I don't even know if we're going to ruin there. Let me do this, and anybody who wants the verses, don't worry about copying them now. I'll just give you, I have all the verses on here, and you can write them down. Okay, so let's look at the verses, and it'll save us a little bit of time. Okay, the first verse we want to look at, and let me tell you right now, this is a systematic theology concerning what the Bible teaches about deceit and how serious a violation it is. Is it a little crime? Is it a little sin? Is it a white lie? What? Okay, so we start with Matthew 23. And we go to Matthew 23, and we want to read 16 to 22. And this is Yeshua talking to and rebuking the Pharisees. Woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple is obligated. You fools and blind men, what is more important, the gold at the temple or the temple that sanctified the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering on it, he is obligated. You blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies it? Therefore, whoever swears by the altar swears by the altar and by everything on it. And whoever swears by the temple swears by both the temple and by him who dwells within it. And whoever swears by heaven swears both by the throne of God and him who sits upon it. Now, just taking that verse right there, we can see that God takes vows very seriously. They're not a small matter with God. And the thing that upset Yeshua was the Pharisees had loopholes in their law all over the place. So if somebody came and entered into an agreement with one of these Pharisees and didn't know all these, the minutiae of the law that they had, and according to the rule, what if I swear by the altar I'm going to do it, and then later on I change my mind. I said, well, in our law, and I make up, this is my excuse, this is the law. See, I'm putting loopholes in the law to my own advantage. Now in Genesis 29:26, but Laban said, it is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn. Thanks for telling me. You see, he's doing exactly what the Pharisees did. He had a loophole because he wanted to get his daughter Leah married. And so he used this loophole. An honest man would have said that first, not after the man was already married. Okay? Now, Matthew 5:33. And just let these roll around in your mind, plus I'm going to be asking some questions, get your opinion on something. And here's Yeshua once again talking about this, and listen what he says. Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is the footstool for his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond these are evil. And you can see what Yeshua is telling there. He's telling the person, when you're talking to somebody about something you don't agree with, don't make a vow to them. I vow by the Lord God. I vow by heaven. I vow by the altar. That's very serious. God takes that very seriously and expects you to do what you're going to say. What God would rather us do is just always say yes if I'm going to do it and no if I'm not going to do it. And after enough time passes, I have a reputation for honesty and integrity. And I don't have to run the risk of making the vow to somebody and then for some reason find out it's to my great disadvantage and try to find a loophole and have my reputation be, you know, become unreliable. Okay. Now, Matthew, well, we did kind of did that already. Matthew, now we go to Psalm 15:4. And I'm hoping you're just going to see a pattern coming through here. Psalm 15:4. Now, this is a very, very important statement in this psalm. Listen to what it says. Let me just start from verse 1 so we can pick up the flow. O Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. He does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against a friend. And here's the key statement, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord. And listen to what he says, key sentence, he swears to his own hurt and does not change. And what that means is, if I tell you, if we enter into an agreement together, and then in the course of time, before we each have fulfilled our obligations, I say to myself, my addition was wrong. I want to lose money on this deal. The Bible says a righteous man will swear to his own hurt. So in other words, what God would expect from me at this point in time is not to find a way to back out of the agreement. But even though the agreement is not going to profit me like I thought it was, I swear to my own hurt. Better you should be an honest man, better is a poor man in his integrity than a rich man who has no integrity. You know, riches come and go, but a reputation stays with you for life. Now, in Matthew 9, now, by the way, what we're doing here, we're going through these verses and we're going to try and come up with a statement. That's what systematic theology is all about. We're looking at numerous verses on the topic, and then we're going to try and draw a conclusion that could be put in a single statement. So Matthew 9, and that's a little bit too much to read. No, that's too long to read, and it doesn't contribute as much as I thought it would. Turn instead to John 8:44. Now, you might be saying to yourself, why is the Lord so riled up about honesty and dishonesty? There's a lot of other sins. Why is honesty and dishonesty really, God shines the light on it in the scriptures? Well, in John 8:44, when Yeshua was having a debate with the Pharisees, and listen what he says, you are of your father the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. Now, if we take that and we go back to Genesis 3:4, what does it mean he is a lie? He is a murderer and there is no truth in him. What's the link between truth and murder? You know, there must be some link there or the Lord wouldn't say it. But in Genesis 3:4, it says, The woman said to the serpent, from the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat, but from the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat it or touch it, or you will die. And listen how brazen this is. The serpent said to the woman, you surely shall not die. What a brazen lie. But unfortunately, the woman was influenced by Satan. She gazed at that fruit. If I were Adam and Eve, I would have built a little shelter as far in the garden away from that tree as I could get it. But she ate of the fruit, and so did her husband. And because Eve believed Satan's lie, the human race died. God murdered the human race with a lie. Now, some people have asked me, why is it Eve's fault all the time? I mean, Adam. Why is Adam the one who has this on his shoulders? And in the New Testament, Adam is always the one we sin in Adam and so forth, and Eve's the one who took the first bite. But listen what it says. In verse 6, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was desirable to make one wise. Now watch, listen carefully to this. She took from the fruit and ate, and she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. When the Satan was talking to the woman and the woman reached up to pluck that piece of fruit off the tree, where was Adam? Right there. He saw the whole thing come down and did nothing. He wasn't being a very good husband, to say the least. Because one of the functions of a husband is to protect his wife. And he didn't protect her. He used her as a pawn. He wanted that fruit. And he figured, well, look, he watched and saw what was happening here. And he said, well, this is working out just the way I wanted it to, because Eve will eat, she'll get the blame, and I'll get to see what it tastes like too. But Adam is the one who's really culpable here. And the thing is, what we find is that Psalm 19:22. Let me just read this one first. Psalm 19:22. No, come on. Let's go. There's no Psalm 19:22, of course. Nah, we don't really don't need those verses. But I think we've seen enough to come to some conclusions. First of all, God hates sin. And in God's eyes, although from a certain perspective we may say some sins are more serious than others, especially during this lifetime, certainly if somebody would ask you, which is the more serious sin, murder or stealing a pack of gum from a store, it's obvious murder is worse because the consequences are worse. But from another perspective, all sin causes death. If the human race, if Adam had not eaten that tree, the fruit of the tree, most theologians believe after some period of time, he would have been confirmed in holiness, and the fruit, the knowledge of the tree of good and evil would have been removed from the garden, and they would have been locked into a permanent state of holiness before God. That's why most theologians, sometimes people ask me, how long after God gave them that commandment to Satan, did he wait a few years? My response is always, he came right away, because he knew the longer he lasted, the longer he waited, the more sure they would become that God was telling them the truth because of all the blessings he poured down on them. And so what we see here is that the human race has fallen into a morass of sin. And what actually happened, if you can picture this in your mind, picture Eve picking a piece of fruit off of a tree. Let's use an apple, for example. We don't know what kind of fruit it was. As she bites into it, every single sin that could be committed by a human being escapes from that fruit and fills the galaxy, fills the universe. It was a Pandora's box that could not be shut. And so from a really good perspective, we can see that sin is sin, and it doesn't really make too much difference how small or how large the sin is from the eternal perspective, because it says in 1 John, God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. And stealing a pack of gum, although it's, we would say as humans, it's not really that serious a thing, it's darkness. It is darkness. And so what we need to do as believers is realize that lying is as serious a sin to God as any other sin there is. The only difference between lying and murder is murder has this finality to it. Once you murder somebody, you can't unmurder them. If you lie to someone, at least you can make it somewhat better by going and telling them the truth. Yes?
I'm thinking there's, I don't know if there's a difference in heaviness per sin, but there are two sins in the Bible that said that, okay, this says God hates liars.
Right.
So that sounds a little stronger to me, but just don't steal. He hates liars, and I don't remember the exact phrasing, but he hates homosexual activity.
Yeah.
So that.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is that, well, here, let's look at this over here. Proverbs 6, just to back up what you're saying, if we go to Proverbs chapter 6, something interesting happens. Now in Proverbs chapter 6, now watch this, just to illustrate how God feels about lying. I want you to picture the author of this proverb, probably Solomon, but we're not sure. There were other authors, and this isn't attributed to anybody. But the author is sitting down with his pen in his hand, and he's going to write a proverb. And he writes, and he wants it to be poetic, and he writes, "There are six things which the Lord hates, yes, seven which are an abomination to him." Then he puts his pen down. And he says to himself, I got to come up with seven biggies, big ones, big, big, big ones. And he starts thinking, what's the worst thing we can do? Notice what he says here. Haughty eyes, that's pride. And Satan's downfall began with his being proud. Now watch. A lying tongue, right? Hands that shed innocent blood. A heart that devises wicked plans. Feet that run rapidly to evil. A false witness who utters lies. When he was searching for seven things to list that God hates, two of them were lying. And it's not just he forgot that he put lying a few lines up and forgot he put it there. He was stressing the fact that to God, a lie is an absolute abomination. It brings dysfunction to families. We've seen in this course what lying did to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all the brothers, and their lives could have been just absolutely wonderful with no strife at all if they had not been liars. Now, fortunately, it didn't bring about their downfall because God is merciful and the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. But nonetheless, it is true that there are a few things we can do in this life that we could say are as serious as lying. And also, one other thing to remember, then we'll move on. One thing about lying, well, two things. First of all, you can't unring a bell. Once you tell a lie, it's out there. And even if you rescind it, it's still out there. You've lied about somebody, especially when it involves gossip and slander. Okay? But let me just, I'll get you 1 second. But the other thing about lying that makes it so serious is it's the gateway to all sin, all of it. Because every sin we commit involves a lie. Every time we sin, we're denying the truth of the fact that it brings a little piece of death into our life. We're following our father, Satan. And as believers, we ought not to do that because he's not our father any longer. We ought to be following God. And a small child, like a toddler, they learn very quickly that if they do something bad and they're called on it and they lie about it, so no, I didn't do that, they learn that most of the time they can get away with it. I didn't do it. I didn't throw the rock that broke the window. I'll get you just 1 second. I didn't throw the rock that broke the window. And they learn that lying is like license to sin. What they don't realize is, it says in the Bible two things you got to remember. One, be sure your sin will find you out. And number two is, all things are naked and open to him with whom we have to deal. So when somebody does something wrong, commits a sin, and then lies about it, they're not fooling anybody but themselves. And one more illustration that I know a couple of you have either question or comments, but one more thing that really illustrates this is, when church first started, the Holy Spirit had an agenda, right? When he came down, day of Pentecost, everybody was filled with the Spirit and, you know, spoke in different tongues. That was the beginning of the church age. And the Holy Spirit had a very important agenda. Now, some man took it upon himself to lie about how much he sold a piece of land for, and he died. When his wife came in, Peter said, did your husband sell this piece of land for such and such? And she lied, and she died. That seems harsh, but the Holy Spirit had a very important agenda. And the Holy Spirit knew, if I overlook a lie, especially at this formative stage of the development of the church is going to be a deceitful group of people, because that's their nature. And what he, in a sense, was doing was he was communicating to the church, you're not of this world anymore. You don't do these things anymore. It's a new day. It's a new life for you. Yes, you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah.
A little louder. I'm a little trouble hearing. If you deceive, is it the same as lying? Well, all lying involves deception, right? When you lie to somebody, you're attempting to deceive them. All deceit involves a lie. You can't deceive someone and claim that you never lied to them. The two words are pretty much synonymous with one another. If I would say to you, watch out when you're dealing with so-and-so, he's a liar. Or I would say, watch out when you do with so-and-so, when you deal with him, he's a deceiver. It's the same warning. It's the same warning. And a lie doesn't necessarily have to be a spoken sentence that contains in it a known falsehood to the person who's saying it. You know, I can deceive you in any number of ways where I don't actually say something that could be caused a lie, but where I intentionally set out to deceive you. So I put both of them on the same par. You had something you wanted to... Yeah.
Because if you ask them, like you say, they're going to lie. So then why set them up with something?
Yeah. And that, that comes across, I was once told something years ago that's along the same lines as those. If you have a child, let's say your own child, and you know they did something bad, don't sit them down and say, why did you do that? Don't make a question, because they'll come up with things. What you say to them is, what did you do? And have them confess it. You know, in our system of law, anybody ever hear the word elocution?
Yes.
If somebody makes a deal with a district attorney in a criminal court, one of the things they have to do is called an elocution, where they admit what they did. And after they do it, the judge will turn to the district attorney and say, are you satisfied with that? Because that's part of the, when they make a deal, you only, if you know, it's to everybody's advantage to make a deal if you can. First of all, criminal cases in court cost thousands of dollars from the district attorney's office. It clogs up the court system, you know? And so they would rather make a deal, unless it's so airtight, but they still might make a deal just so they don't have to go into court and waste all that time and money, and they know what the end is going to be. Yes?
But that's still a system where we're, now somebody can say, I'm not guilty, and everybody knows he's guilty. We set up that system where we have said, you're entitled to a lawyer. First thing, virtually nobody goes into court and admits to guilt. It has, the crime they're charged with is decided on by the judge or the jury. But all of these, we've got thousands, if not millions, of people who consider it their civil right to walk into court and say, I am not guilty. And then you dither over plea bargains, and then there's a thing.
Yeah, but you see,
it saves the community money, but it has ruined.
But wait, you gotta watch how carefully how this happens. Okay, well then you know, when somebody commits a crime, and the district attorney determines that it's manslaughter too, there are degrees of murder, and then there's also degrees of manslaughter, a lesser charge. They still may want to make a deal. But no judge in his right mind is going to look at a case that's scheduled to come to court, but they're still in negotiations. And see, the judge has to accept the deal. But wait, the judge has to accept it. And so a district attorney knows that if he goes from murder one to manslaughter three, the judge is going to say, that's too far. But you're not, who's telling the person to lie?
Pardon me?
Who's telling who to lie?
The system that has said, we're going to do a plea bargain so we don't cost the citizens so much.
Yeah, but when they do a plea bargain, the difference between the punishment they would get if they went to court and the punishment that they get in a plea bargain, the distance can only be, it can't be very far.
If I've done something, it is a lie. It may be my civil right, but it is a lie before God to walk into court and say, I'm not guilty.
Well, when you do an allocution, you don't do that. An allocution is an admission of guilt.
It's an admission of what you pled guilty to at the end of the session. After you have said your lie, I am not guilty, and you've accepted this plea bargain that's for a lesser charge, then you do your allocution, and there is a sense in which you can't, many things, you can't hardly tell the whole truth of what you did. You've got to make your allocution match your plea bargain. You've got your societal, agreed upon, encouraged lie on the grounds, and that's part of how the this country is going down so fast that we have ruined.
Well, I agree with you 100% that our system of justice in this country is disheveled. I agree with that. But I'm talking about the way the law is supposed to work. It doesn't, you know, our system is corrupt, and I agree with you on that. All I'm saying is that in our system of justice, a person can be called into the district attorney's office with their attorney, and the attorney may present certain evidence they have, and when they first go in, and this is not unusual, and you may have seen scenes like that on, like this on shows like Law and Order, the attorney and the accused sit down with the district attorney. First of all, that doesn't happen to begin with. No attorney in his right mind lets one of his clients talk to a district attorney, period. But it makes for good drama on TV. But let's pretend for a minute that happened. So when they first sit down, the attorney's going to say, my client didn't do anything. And then the district attorney will present him with evidence that clearly shows that he did it. The next thing the attorney will do will say, what are you offering? That's the next thing they'll say. What will you offer in return for a guilty plea? And then the attorney has the job of determining, is it worth the risk to go to trial and risk 30 years in prison? And in all likelihood, he will be found guilty because the evidence is strong. Or is the evidence so weak that it won't even get past the arraignment stage? See, first you have to be arraigned. Arraignment is when you stand before a judge and he just sees if there's enough evidence for it to even go to court. But anyway, getting back to where we were, you can see that lying, how can you have a relationship built on a lie? Husbands and wives lying to one another, what kind of relationship is that? How can you possibly have the intimate kind of relationship God desires for a husband and his wife when it's built upon lies? It just can't, it can't go forward. It really can't.
Also, Mark, is an exaggeration a lie when you exaggerate things way out of proportion?
Well, my question to you would be, that exaggeration, you know, it says in the Bible, bad, bad, says the buyer, but when he goes his way, he boasts. He made a good deal. Now, it's not always deceptive to haggle successfully, but it does get to a point where if I'm going to sell you my car and it turns out that you ask me, how's the car running? My car's running fine. It's not giving me any trouble at all. If it turns out that within a very brief period of time, like a day or two, it turns out the car's a piece of junk, you can go to civil court and have the transaction reversed. And you may also be able to go to criminal court. Of course, he could be accused of a fraud. Yes?
And so many people, the victims, don't want to bother because you lose your pay from a day off work. And there's...
Well, of course, one of the problems they have in our justice system is the problem of rape. When there's a rape that takes place, one of the things that the district attorney needs is they need the person who was raped to be a witness.
Depends on the state. California will prosecute the person charged with rape even if the victim refuses to
I don't know how strong, I don't know if that's ever been tested on a federal level, but it's contrary to our Constitution. So I don't know if that's ever been tested. Because one of the firm rights we have, and this is as solid as freedom of speech, is you have a right to face your accuser. And that's in the Constitution. Well, what I'm saying is, yeah, but what I'm saying is, I have a right to face my accuser. That's a federal statute, and federal statutes trump state statutes. Now, there are certain exceptions to that. Obviously, if I do something to you that renders you unable to testify, so there's always exceptions, but. One of the things, all I'm saying is, one of the problems that they have in our system of justice is that in order to get a rape conviction, generally speaking, there may be exceptions, I don't think there are, but if there was exceptions, you need the person who was raped to get up on the witness stand and tell from her side of her, you know, her part what happened. And that makes for a very strong witness for the jury to see her do that. Now, district attorneys, by and large, don't like prosecuting rape cases. And the reason is it makes the victim live the crime again.
Plus, go through all of the nasty things that any defense
attorney... Oh, yeah, the defense attorney is going to... It's horrific what the defense attorney is going to do. It used to be, as a matter of fact, that and they can't do this any longer, that the defense attorney could bring up the past sexual behaviors of the victim. Now they can only do that if it forms a pattern of behavior. So, for example, if I'm accused of raping a woman, the district attorney may not... Let's say I was guilty of a rape 5 years ago. He can't bring that up in court. You can't bring past bad acts up in court. It's just not permissible. However, if I have a history of rape and there's something about the way, what I do when I rape women that's consistent and forms a pattern, that's the time you can bring up, and that applies to all crimes. You know, if I'm an arsonist and I always use the same method of burning a building down, if you can show a pattern of behavior, then it's acceptable. But if you can't show a pattern of behavior, it's not acceptable. And so if a man rapes you, his attorney says to you, well, how many men have you slept with in the last year? Your attorney immediately will say objection, and it will be sustained.
In California, but not in every state. That's another state.
Yeah, I'm going to look into that. I want to, because I know it's a federal law. It's a federal law. The accuser, the person accusing them, the victim.
All I know is it's a fact that in California, once the police report is made on a sex-related case, they carry on without you if you refuse to testify. Now, at that point, they may not have any chance of winning the case.
But again, and I'll have to check into this, according to federal law, regardless of what the crime is, you have a constitutional right to face your accuser. And that came over from England because they used to charge people with crimes. And I was charged with stealing something from you. And, you know, I'm brought to court and they wouldn't bring you to court. And it's really not equitable for me to be accused and cross-examined and so forth, but you not. that my defense attorney doesn't have an opportunity to question you and the validity of what you're saying. And so one of the things we have to remember is that, now here's something the police are allowed to do. You know, when you watch a show like Law and Order, for example, when you watch a show like Law and Order, one of the things that they do is they lie to the accused. The policeman will lie to the accused. We got your partner in crime in the other room down there, and he's spilling his guts. Or we got your partner in crime in the room down there, and we only need one of the two of you as a witness that you did this, and the first one who folds will get a lesser sentence. They lie like that. Once in a while, I'll watch this show on TV. It's called Cops. And it's where it's a reality show. It's where somebody follows policemen on their, you know, shift with a camera. And the policemen start asking all different kinds of questions. And I don't know where they get these people from, but if I were ever stopped, like if I were driving my car and a policeman pulled me over and started asking me questions, I would say to him, I want my attorney. And then I don't have to open my mouth after that. And if he asked, he would have to ask, if he asked permission to search my car, I would say no. He said, it's going to be searched. I said, you have no probable cause. He has to have a reason beyond the fact that he just wants to search your car. I remember once, and it was scary for me, I was at this girl's house, and we were watching movies. This is when I was like 19 years old. And I decided to go home, and I lived about a good 45-minute walk from her house, and it started to pour. But it wasn't very cold yet, and I was just getting soaked. And I figured, I'll get home, and I'll take a shower, and I'll feel warm again. All of a sudden, the policeman pulled up, and here's this lone traveler in the rain. What had happened was some man who had a drugstore, somebody broke into the drugstore and stole a whole bunch of drugs. The man lived in the apartment above, and he saw the person who did it. And I fit the description. So they put me in the police car, and they took me to the scene of the crime. And I said to myself, I know I didn't do this, but I just hope this guy really knows what the guy looks like. And they had me stand there, and police all over the place with the flashing lights. And the man came over and looked at me, and I was a nervous wreck. And the man said, that's not him. That was it. As a matter of fact, the police were nice enough to give me a ride home so I didn't have to get wet. So I didn't have to walk another 30 minutes in the rain. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Excuse me? There's certain conditions under which you don't have to go with the police. Generally speaking, you do when a crime is being investigated. But the smartest thing to do, if you know you've done no wrong, number one, keep your mouth closed. Because no matter what you didn't do and how honest you are, they got 1,000 tricks up their sleeves. Yeah, I know.
And in the school, in the high school, the policeman, and I told my younger son not to even speak to him. They, when crimes occur, they send out spies, and they try to, just for their own fun, try to commit petty crimes and kids in the school. Mm-hmm. And I really have to tell you that
Right. But according to our law in this country, you are not obligated to say a word to anyone. You say, I want an attorney, and you don't have to open your mouth after that. You don't have to say a word. And if they decide they want to search your car, say to them, you have no probable cause, and I am not giving you permission to search my car. And then anything they find in my car, even if it's something that's linked to the crime, is not admissible in court. Yes?
I've told my husband over and over again, if the police, if they come to the door of the house, either if they ask if they can come in,
nope.
Certainly say no.
Nope.
And if they ask you to step outside
nope.
And talk to them, you don't do it. You refuse because then they can.
Yeah, you always keep that barrier. You always keep that barrier up.
I will tell you right now, from what I've seen, a friend of mine who gets a fire captured and innocently outside of her house went in and called the police, and she had been in the hospital and she was arrested for drink driving. So I will not, if they come to my door, I will not answer the door. I've seen what they've done to me.
Right. What all of this illustrates, though, getting back on point, what all of this illustrates, and these conversations we're having is good because it illustrates the absolute destructiveness of lying. It's because people lie. You know, prisons are full of innocent men. I remember once I used to lift weights and I went, competitively, and I went to a prison with a friend of mine, a couple of friends of mine, because they were having a weightlifting contest in the prison. And I never met so many innocent men in my life. There was, of all the guys I talked to, one admitted he did it. One admitted he did it, no one else. Anyway, just to get back on point for a minute, this is good. Discussions like this are good. I think that God holds the believer to a higher standard. He expects the non-believer to lie when the non-believer thinks it's to his or her advantage. And they will be held accountable for that. But I think that if a believer, we all lie. That's just the way, it's the human condition. But if a believer becomes a compulsive liar, God would severely bring discipline into that believer's life, because that does not glorify God. And I know, I have learned from my relationship with my wife, of all the things I can possibly do that will get her upset, not being 100% truthful with her is way at the top. If a man wants to have a successful marriage, you have to have honesty in the marriage, because if there's no trust, the marriage is broken. And bear in mind again, even if you're in business, if you get a reputation as a liar, people won't want to do business with you. They'll demand cash up front. It's really to your disadvantage to lie, although a lot of people think it's to your advantage to lie because you can get what you want. But it's like Shakespeare said, oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. And that's what it is. When you tell one lie, it often leads to another, and another, and another. And then you got to make sure your story's straight. That's why sometimes if they get a guy in the police station who will talk to them with an attorney there, they'll say, now tell us what happened. You do it. And then 15 minutes later, somebody will come in and say, nope, Tell me what happened. They'll do that 5 or 6 times. And any contradictions at all, they'll hone right in on them. Well, we didn't get too far into chapter 34, but that's okay. I think these conversations are enlightening once in a while. Let's close with a word of prayer. Lord, thank you for this time in your word. And Lord, thank you. I appreciate that I'm not the only one in this room who sees that lying is serious and who's not given this thought. Because we know that Satan is the father of lies, and we certainly don't want him as our father. I pray that you will help us to be honest in all our dealings with both believers, non-believers, ourselves, and you. Because lying leads to death. Now, Lord, I pray you'll give everybody a safe ride home. Watch everybody during this week. Watch over everybody. And give us a good time next week in your word. In Yeshua's name, amen. You know what else is funny?